short according to their own sea level rise projections. This used to be wetland. We need these strong roots of these trees. We need wetlands. We need decking over the FDR. We need a plan that works with the sea as we work on climate change. Climate justice is racial justice.
A kind of green celebration in New York. And finally, George Floyd family attorney Penn Crump just spoke moments ago in Minneapolis outside the courthouse, where we discovered just a short time ago that the officer charged with murder in the killing of George Floyd, Derek Chauvin, has been convicted, found guilty of all charges, including murder, that were leveled against him. We're going to go now to a few moments of Attorney Crump.
Let's pause for a moment to proclaim this historical moment, not just for the legacy of George Floyd, but for the legacy of America. The legacy of trying to make America for all Americans. So that George Floyd's victory and America's quest for equal justice under the law would be intertwined. America, let's frame this moment as a moment where we finally are getting close to living up to our Declaration of Independence, that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equally, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that amongst them are life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. Where America, that means all of us. That means black people. That means Hispanic people. That means Native people. That means Asian people. That means all of us, America. We frame this moment for all of us, not just for George Floyd. This is a victory for those who champion humanity over inhumanity, those who champion justice over injustice, those who champion morals over immorality. America, let's lean into this moment and let's make sure, Reverend Al, that this moment will be documented for our children yet unborn as they continue on the journey to justice, knowing that the blood of George Floyd will give them a trail to find a way to a better America, a more just America. A more just America where Breonna Taylor gets an opportunity to sleep in peace at night without the police busting in her front door. A more just America where Ahmaud Arbery gets to run free and not be lynched for jogging while black. A more just America where Jacob Blake and Anthony McLean and Walter Scott and Laquan McDonald and all these other black men, Terrence Crutcher, who was shot in the back while running away like Dante Wright was just a week ago, because for some reason, black men running away from the police is more dangerous than young white men who commit mass murders and walk towards the police with an assault weapon, Reverend Bryant, like Kyle Rittenhouse in Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Wow.
America, let this be the precedent.
Yes.
Let this be the precedent where we live up to the high ideals and the promises when we say liberty and justice for all. Those sun-kissed children are included in all. Those children who overcame slavery, the Middle Passage, the Dred Scott decision, mm-hmm. Plessy v. Ferguson, Jim Crow, and his much smarter, wiser son, Jim Crow Jr., Esquire. Let this be the precedence where we overcome systematic racism and oppression, and that we are a better people, and we will leave our children a better world for us all.
And that was attorney, George Floyd family attorney, Ben Crump. And as celebrations broke out all over Minneapolis, the sounds of power to the people were heard here in New York City as hundreds gathered in Union Square to celebrate Derek Chauvin's guilty verdict. And to recap the news, a Minneapolis, Minnesota jury returned guilty verdicts for the white former police officer charged with murder in the killing of George Floyd. Derek Chauvin listened without expression as Judge Peter Cahill announced guilty verdicts in the charges of secondary unintentional murder, third-degree depraved mind murder, and second-degree manslaughter in the explosive case that triggered worldwide protests, violence, and a coming to terms with racism in the United States. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, April 20th, 2021. The news was produced with Linda Perry and many other people joining us from WPFW, Eskia Muhammad, the news director there, and others. Our engineer, Reggie Johnson, did an incredibly yeoman's job, as usual, pulling this all together. From New York City, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI.
Welcome to the Rebellion.
Welcome to Extinction Rebellion Radio. Extinction Rebellion is a politically nonpartisan international movement that uses nonviolent direct action to persuade governments to act justly on the climate and ecological emergency. Here now, to begin our show for this week, is Extinction Rebellion Radio's climate news for the week.
More than 13,000 scientists around the world have declared that we are living in a climate emergency. 400 news outlets worldwide, including Scientific American, The Guardian, The Columbia Journalism Review, The Nation, Noticias, Telemundo, Al Jazeera, and others will now use the term climate emergency in their coverage of climate change. A January 2021 article in Scientific American stated, quote, "The adverse effects of climate change are much more severe than expected and now threaten both the biosphere and humanity. Every effort must be made to reduce emissions and increase removal of atmospheric carbon in order to restore the melting Arctic and end the deadly cycle of damage that the current climate is delivering," end quote. The article also noted that as of January, 1,859 jurisdictions in 33 countries have issued climate emergency declarations covering more than 820 million people. So far, the United States has not declared a climate emergency. Extinction Rebellion chapters have recently called on the Biden administration to do precisely that, declare a climate emergency and then act on it.
If you're one of the estimated 50 million Americans who suffer from allergies, climate change is making you more miserable than ever. According to an article in Vox, the heating of the earth is increasing both the length and intensity of allergy season as pollen, particularly tree pollen, spreads over the eastern United States in ever greater quantities. Just what you need, more pollen. The previous 3 years were particularly intense for those suffering from an allergic reaction to pollen. Like 2020, this year is further complicated by the COVID-19 pandemic, and even more complicated still by the fact that many allergic people have also been adversely affected, at least temporarily, by symptoms caused by the various COVID vaccines. So an interesting aspect to the story is it's now being claimed that many people who have never before been allergic may become so by developing a new sensitivity to the enormous and increasing amount of pollen generated by climate change. So that is, even people who weren't allergic before might become allergic or get new allergies triggered because the amount of pollen keeps going up and up and up. So many out there seem to have difficulty connecting climate-related phenomena to economic effects. So consider this. the annual cost of treating nasal allergies in this country is nearly $3.5 billion and rising. And last year, allergies resulted in over 20,000 emergency room visits. And these figures do not even include lost work productivity as a result of allergy-related symptoms. By the way, it's normal but quite nerve-wracking for people to mistake the symptoms of allergies for the symptoms of COVID-19. So the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology has published a chart helpfully distinguishing these symptoms. In summary, fever, cough, shortness of breath, and muscle aches are common symptoms of COVID but not of allergies, whereas itchy eyes and sneezing are common symptoms of allergy, but rarely of COVID. Two protests to announce. First, Extinction Rebellion Youth in New York City are doing a coordinated guerrilla sticker and poster campaign. Many of the posters are already up in the Financial District of New York City. The main target is Chase Bank. Posters say, "Wanted for funding climate catastrophe," with a picture of Jamie Dimon. Chase Bank has given billions to the fossil fuel industry and funded pipelines like the Keystone XL, Mountain Valley, and Line 3, making the climate crisis worse. Second, for any of you in the Boston area or any of you who want to go there, XR Boston has an Earth Day action this Sunday, April 25th at 1 p.m. And we think it will be big. The Boston Newsletter says this: the action will kick off shortly after 1 p.m. with speakers from Extinction Rebellion, Eastie Farm, and Stop the Money Pipeline. We will then turn our climate grief into love and action through dancing, chanting, and singing before taking to the street in a vibrant parade with fanfare and art from our recent Winds of Change event. There will be performance brigades, the Red Rebels, the Ocean People, some climate firefighters, and the Songbirds for Survival. So again, 1 p.m., Sunday, April 25th, at the Massachusetts State House. Voice of America is reporting that President Biden will host a virtual summit of dozens of world leaders to discuss climate change on April 22nd and April 23rd. According to University of Maryland Center for Global Sustainability Director Nathan Hultman, the summit will be, quote, a coming out party for the United States on climate change, unquote. Though if this is so, the party will be a very belated one. The United States has, of course, lost a great deal of credibility over the last 4 years, as our most recent president not only pulled the United States out of the Paris Agreement, but denied the very existence of climate change, despite wildfires, hurricanes, and other disasters. Oh, and by the way, despite increasing global temperatures, about which he did exactly nothing. This summit is thus an opportunity for a reboot for America as a global leader in the struggle against climate chaos. At least that's the most optimistic scenario. The story, as is typical for American government publications, and many that the government doesn't directly control as well, the story stressed the problem of China's noncompliance with its climate commitments, rather than the problem of America's noncompliance. But such criticisms ring hollow. Everyone knows that China will not change its behavior and make the necessary sacrifices if the United States doesn't change its behavior and lead the way.
There's been a lot of commentary lately, both in mainstream media and more independent sources, about the Biden climate plan. We have a two-part segment now that both is and is not about the president's plan. Yes, we will discuss the Biden plan, but also the Green New Deal, or GND, and the Paris Accords. And we will show how all three fall short of the goals that America and the world, according to the science, need to achieve. Then in an upcoming show, that will be the second part. We'll discuss a vision of the future that goes beyond these inadequate establishment solutions. We thus hope we can help our listeners think about the climate crisis in a post-COVID world in a whole new way.
The first thing that should be noted about the Biden plan is that it is being marketed as a very American challenge, rather like the moon landings in the 60s and 70s, or the space shuttle in later decades. It is an initiative being characterized as, in the words of the New York Times, quote, the next great test of American ingenuity, unquote. What the plan is not being presented as is an existential imperative, like the national mobilization that America embarked upon after its entry into World War II. During that period, the message was spread far and wide that if the fascists won, then we, the people of the United States, would be toast. We've maintained in previous shows that America's response to Pearl Harbor could be the model for the U.S. government's strategy on the climate front, so that we don't all almost literally become toast. However, there is no commensurate sense of urgency coming from the Biden administration.
Not at all. And this is reflected in the plan's proposed deadline to achieve net zero carbon emissions. 2050 is the proposal, a date that most scientists would agree is far too late. The more realistic deadline for being able to stave off planetary catastrophe is 2030, and only 9 years it is in the future. There are many reasons for the plan's inadequacy, but the essential one is that it mindlessly embraces a philosophy of endless economic growth, the same concept that got us into this mess to begin with. Only a philosophy of controlled economic degrowth can hope to overcome the monstrous catastrophe facing us. But degrowth is bad for corporate profits, or drastically reduced profits, at least for many of the most established corporations. And that's anathema to the people who pay our politicians.
Even when President Biden was candidate Biden, activists took issue with his climate pronouncements, particularly his false claim that not a single climate scientist believes the greenhouse gases could be reduced to net zero by 2030. For the record, that's false. There are climate scientists who believe the greenhouse gases could and must be reduced to net zero by 2030. In March of last year, the Real News Network released on YouTube the comments of Leela Korman Glazer, director of 350 New Hampshire Action, about the inadequate response of Democrats, including Biden, to climate change.
My entire life, Democrats have been failing to address the climate crisis, and we desperately need the Democratic candidate for president to be a climate champion. We're running out of time.
So we have an alleged climate plan from the president that, though it correctly identifies the oil and gas industries as culprits, doesn't ban fracking, supports quote-unquote clean nuclear, as if this exists, and relies on what we call fake solutions.
You're listening to WBAI's Extinction Rebellion Radio with Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane, and we're talking about recent climate crisis news and the Biden plan. So what is a fake solution? It's a proposed response to the climate crisis, usually intended to benefit some profit-making entity that is utterly ineffective or actually harmful, according to the best available evidence. Another kind of fake solution is one that has never been proven to be even possible, much less workable. The burden of proof is on the people who are calling a solution a solution. If we really do get clear and strong evidence that these are compatible with an emission-free future, then we'll stop calling it a fake solution. But so far, a lot of the so-called solutions look, pretty fake. An example of the first type of fake solution is biomass, which uses land that might be used for growing food to grow plants for fuel. This energy source doesn't resolve the climate crisis, since CO2 emissions will still be generated. And some sources claim that the emissions generated by biomass would, actually be worse than those released by coal. And even if biomass were an effective alternative to fossil fuels, the use of land to create it would mean much less land to grow food that could feed all of us, particularly in the developing countries of the global south. Food insecurity is already a major concern in many parts of the world, and the mass use of land for fuel development would only make it worse. The creation of cheap energy for the global north should never be achieved at the cost of the welfare of the people of the global south. An example of the second definition of a fake solution, scientifically dubious or completely unproven proposals, is carbon capture and storage, and that's sometimes called carbon capture and sequestration, also known as CCS. This is intended as a get-out-of-jail card for the coal industry. CCS may save carbon emissions at the site of the actual burning of coal, but even if it works, it will probably generate more emissions in the mining and transportation of it, having little effect or even a negative effect on the ultimate goal of reducing emissions. This is not to mention the fact that there are no guarantees whatsoever that the carbon waste we store underground will actually stay there and not leak out. Now, there's another fake solution that's even worse than the two examples I just mentioned. This is the so-called carbon offsets policy, a favorite of millionaires and billionaires, right? With carbon offsets, one can quote-unquote neutralize the carbon emitted by, say, your own private jet. Many of us don't have that, right? by paying for the planting of a few trees, or perhaps by underwriting a new startup or some new geoengineering experiment, possibly conducted at the expense of the rights of an indigenous population. So you go right on emitting. You just pay somebody else for something that doesn't emit. Now, with carbon offsets, emissions keep happening, right? Carbon offsets are not a pathway to an emission-free future. You just keep emitting. But doesn't the Biden plan also encourage solar and wind energy, you ask? Well, yeah, it does. But its emphasis is on the consumer adoption of these energy sources. Only a quarter of greenhouse gas production comes from consumers, however. The administration has had nothing to say about the three quarters of greenhouse gas production that's currently created by the energy, commercial, transportation, and manufacturing sectors. And they certainly don't propose any mechanism to pressure these industries to adopt solar or wind energy. But perhaps more importantly, the Biden plan intends to devote just $2 trillion to fund its campaign to reverse climate change. Now, we realize how mind-boggling it must seem that a couple of trillion dollars, a trillion means a million millions, right, could possibly appear in any context a paltry sum. But in the context of the cost of the climate crisis, think Manhattan, think about Miami, New Orleans, Boston, think about San Francisco area, that's where I'm at, and every beach in the entire world underwater, every small island nation literally washed off the map. And that's just the beginning, et cetera, et cetera. When you think about all that and recognize that drastic measures are needed to deal with the climate crisis, then an amount like $2 trillion doesn't even seem so drastic after all. We just spent that on a coronavirus stimulus. $2 trillion is well under $6,000 for every person in America. As one of the main polluters in the world, the United States is morally responsible for the survival and welfare of the other people on this planet. In the long run, it's going to save money anyhow. So we shouldn't be shy about asking for what it's going to take.
Now let's talk about the Green New Deal. It's abbreviated GND, proposed by progressive Democrats. This is not to be confused with something called the Green New Deal, originally proposed by the Green Party, which is a whole other plan. So for this broadcast, when we say GND, we mean the Green New Deal from the Democrats. The GND offers, to be fair, many positive features not offered by the Biden plan. The GND emphasizes community enforcement and control to a much greater degree than the president's plan, with a focus on the use of public banks to break up monopolies and funnel funds into communities directly. About the importance of using public banks to reverse climate change, here is a recent recording of Extinction Rebellion activists in New York City going to private banks to protest their profiting off of climate death by loaning money to the fossil fuel industry.
Can we talk to someone about the $5.15 billion that you're building for Line 3 pipeline?
Are either of you aware of the Line 3 pipeline?
Do you know that Wells Fargo is investing $3.86 billion in the Line 3 pipeline?
Can you ask your employer to reconsider who they're financing and
the
projects that they're financing?
Do you understand the consequences of this pipeline?
Do your clients know that the money is going towards climate destruction? Are you making this information aware to all of your clients, readily available, so they understand where their dollars are going, to basically destroy our planet for the next generation?
This is locking us into a fossil fuel future that no one is asking for.
The GND also prioritizes the creation of millions of well-paid union jobs for the people who least benefit from the present system. The plan is adaptable by state or local governments, which could decide to go beyond the federal government's actions in adopting such concepts as degrowth. The GND also, according to both proponents and opponents, costs much more than the Biden plan, which from our point of view is a good thing, implying that they are taking seriously what's required to address this crisis. But the GND plan also shares many flaws with the Biden plan. Both plans have a net zero emissions deadline of 2050, with an emphasis on a big push by 2030. But 2050 is decades too late. As one Extinction Rebellion protest sign said, 2050 is climate death. Both plans relegate the greening of commercial buildings, infrastructure, and transportation to fourth or fifth priority instead of second priority. Both fail to take the roles of seaports and transnational transportation into account. Perhaps most crucially, the oversight, monitoring, and regulation of polluters are not addressed by either plan. Say that again. The oversight, monitoring, and regulation of polluters is not addressed by either the Biden plan or the GND. A ban on nuclear energy included in the original version of the GND was deliberately excluded from the final version, although climate activists do disagree about the advisability of nuclear power. Maybe we'll talk about that in another show. And under the GND, fracking is not explicitly banned, as there's no direct language used to ban the procedure. So that leaves the issue open to some interpretation. While the Biden plan, as already mentioned, costs $2 trillion from start to finish, a figure of $10 trillion was mentioned by Congresswoman Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez as the GND's starting costs. Now, there are fierce critics of the plan who say, no, no, this is going to cost much more even than that. Folks are throwing around these tremendous cost estimates, but those so-called estimates vary massively. We're not talking about hard data here. Now, we don't dismiss concerns about cost, but our listeners should remember a couple of things about cost when you start hearing really big financial numbers. First, public officials, I know you'll all be shocked to hear this, public officials do sometimes throw out numbers for which they do not have hard data. I know you don't think they would ever do such a thing, but it has been known to happen, our public officials. But the other thing about cost is that it has to be compared to what it's going to cost humanity if we do nothing, morally and financially, what it's going to cost us if we do nothing. And that amount is fantastically high. Trillions of dollars in cost might be a good bargain if it prevents hundreds of trillions in losses. This is the way to frame the cost discussion. The GND does aim to curb those catastrophes, and it aims to offer long-term solutions for social injustices.
Now, we shall briefly discuss the Paris Climate Accords, also known simply as the Paris Agreement. Generally speaking, international climate agreements have been, you know, disasters. The Paris Accords, while a positive development in some ways, are no exception. The big upside to the Paris Accords is that they are an improvement on the old Kyoto Agreement because the deadline for achieving net zero emissions is fixed. Kyoto had no fixed deadline. Paris has a fixed deadline, but it's too late. So neither of these is good, but Paris does have that step in the right direction. There is also, under the Paris Agreement, more international participation, and more money is being demanded for global environmental reform. The big downside to the Paris Agreement is that although the deadline is finally fixed, it uses the same totally unscientific deadline of 2050 as the Biden plan and the GND. And also when it comes to enforcement, it's like a toothless watchdog. There is zero enforcement of any of the rules in the Paris Agreement. They are totally voluntary. Its architects are essentially wagging their collective finger at participant countries, including some of the richest and most powerful countries in the world, like the U.S., and saying, be good. Finally, the agreement advocates some of the fake solutions already mentioned. You're listening to WBAI's Extinction Rebellion Radio with Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane, and we're talking about the Biden plan, the Paris Climate Accords, and the GND. Although the 2015 Paris Agreement is inadequate in respect to timeline and enforcement, it's a step forward in recognizing the responsibilities of developed countries, for example, the U.S., United Kingdom, the EU countries. It's recognizing their responsibility to financially assist and to share technology and information with developing countries for adaptation and mitigation of climate change. Particularly, the Paris Accords recognize developing countries' vulnerability to climate change. It's not hard to understand why the agreement is so inadequate, though. Fossil fuel corporations had a seat at the negotiating table, and climate activists did not. In this clip from a December 2015 broadcast of Democracy Now!, publicly available on YouTube, English activist George Barda of Occupy Democracy talks about what's at stake and why the agreement falls short of what's required.
My name's George and I'm from London and part of the Occupy movement and a climate activist of many years. And like so many thousands of others, I had to be here because the fate of the world pretty much is going to be decided by the combination of the relative failure of this agreement and our ability today and going forward, especially in the next couple of years, to stand up against the insanity that it represents. I mean, we're talking already with 1 degree about hundreds of millions of people affected traumatically by droughts, floods, crop destruction. torrential rains, typhoons, etc. And meanwhile, you have France and the US, apparently part of the coalition of ambition, saying they want 1.5 degrees. At the same time, there's shale oil, shale gas, coal, tar sands, you name it, and they're trying to push through all these trade deals, which we all know are going to lock in a situation where it's virtually impossible to get the change we need to see. So now is the most important time for human history, and it's strange to be able to say that, having really reflected on that, and I honestly think that's true, and we are the ones we've been waiting for.
The 2023 deadline, as stated in Article 14, for taking global